The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Sian Kane.
Me, Richard Lee.
And me, Claire Armistead.
This week, we speak to the novelist Samantha Harvey about her memoir of insomnia, The Shapeless Unease. But first...
Her knowledge is vast, her hand reaches out and pulls the spine of a beautifully bound book of delights picked especially for me. Ooh, I'm so
in a shop with books, in a shop with books,
in a shop with books,
in a shop with books.
Did that little doozy of a tune give you a hint as to what I'm about to discuss? We're talking bookshops, of course. It's January and it's dark, and so here is some good news. Independent bookshops are on the up.
Yay!
What's the story, Richard?
Well, the Booksellers Association figures reveal that last year, 890 bookshops were existing in the UK. That's independent bookshops, of course. This is an increase of just 7 shops, with some closing and more opening and so on, but this is the third year in a row of increases. This is after a 20-year decline. Back in 1995, there were 1,894 shops. There were fewer then every year, people going out of business, bookshops closing, until rock bottom was reached in 2016 with 867. Then in 2017, there was one. Yes, count it, one more.
I remember when we did that news story and I was trying to explain to everyone why it was such a big event. I was like, one bookshop opened last year.
Exactly. And then there was a massive 15 more in 2018, and now the third year in a row, back another 7, so back up to 890. So there you go, it's definitely true.
That's pretty good. So the rock bottom in 2016 was 867, and now we're on 890. So that's a nice little increase over 3 years.
There's a bookshop near me, which was called the Big Green Bookshop in Wood Green in North London, which was one of my favourites, which closed in January and went online only. And it led me to wonder whether actually most of these had opened out of big city centres. Is that right?
Well, quite a lot of the shops that did open in 2019 were outside of London. Of course, it's a sort of net gain of 7 shops. So there are more than 7 bookshops, independent bookshops, that opened last year. But the overall increase is by 7 shops.
So what do we think is going on here?
Well, I mean, this is sort of a conversation that has been had, I think, sort of more widely about UK high street. So obviously the UK high street's in quite a lot of trouble at the moment. And the shops that tend to be closing have been shops that perhaps have slightly detached attitude towards the retail experience, I guess. And I guess what indie bookshops do better than, say, often, not always, but often more than a chain bookshop, is that you have staff that are incredibly invested in the bookshop itself. So whether they've personally curated the stock, you know, they can be really, really specialised and sell quite strange things, but sell them well.
Like for example, there's this lovely little bookshop in London called Persephone Books, which has actually been going for quite a while, which specialises in books by women authors who have gone out of print, with nice end papers.
Yes, usually very nice covers.
they publish as well as sell.
Exactly, and it's that sort of, I think that can be sometimes what people are after, is a sort of sense of a... expertise that can be inherent in like quite a sort of small retail space, because they have to really concentrate on you know, what they're going to sell. So you do often see indie bookshops that have a very specialized focus in terms of the books that they stock.
It's been a bad year for libraries at the same time as it's a good year for bookshops. Do you think that bookshops are taking over from libraries, in that booksellers have that thing that one always says of a good librarian, that they're able to point you in the direction you never knew you wanted to go?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it is a service that both are providing.
The decline in libraries is just simply a function of the catastrophic level of funding of local government, isn't it?
Yeah.
People would like to go to libraries. People think librarians are great, in the same way that a good bookseller is great, but it's just that the government has been cutting the knees of local government for a little while now, so that only goes for a certain amount of time.
And I'd guess that I would almost say that perhaps there isn't too much crossover, in that the reason people often use libraries is that they can't afford to buy books. So whether these people are actually going to bookshops to buy books because they can't go to their library anymore, I'm not sure whether.
Sometimes they don't buy books. Much Ado is a little bookshop in the just on the South Downs Walk, which is one of my favourites, and it has armchairs. Mm-hmm. And if you're going, you're very tired halfway through a leg across the South Downs, you just go and sit in their armchairs and pretend to be maybe going to buy one of their secondhand books. And they actually sometimes even give you cookies when you're in your armchair.
Oh, what, really? And then you just leave? I'd be so guilty. I'd buy like 50 books because they gave me a biscuit.
But the problem is, as they know, then you'd have to put it in your rucksack and take it the rest of your walk along the South Downs.
Part of it, I think, is also this realisation of the kind of smallness not being a problem. I think a bookshop used to think 20, 30 years ago that it had to have lots of books so you could find the thing you were looking for. Mm. But the existence of Amazon, which has got everything, and the also combined with the fact of just-in-time delivery, means that bookshops now think that all they need to do is offer a kind of window into things, an experience that can't be replicated by Amazon's awful kind of try this next kind of piece of software, and know that if you want a book, they can get it for you the next day.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the difference. I love this. I think we're going to have to coin a new set of phrases, which is the everython, which is the huge great bookshop, and the sprint, which is the little bookshop, which is specialist and will get you what you want very quickly.
The everython. To explore what's behind all this, we thought we'd pick up the phone to one of our favourite bookshops, Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights in Bath, the picturesque West Country city immortalised in a million Jane Austen adaptations. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, Nick. Hi. We thought of you because we all love Mr. B's Emporium, not least because it's possibly the only bookshop in the world that spawned its own folk band. We played a bit of the bookshop band earlier. So now you also happen to be president of the Booksellers Association, who released these figures. It's quite a small increase.
Yes.
Is it significant?
It is significant because I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. One is that for 20 years, you know, as was much reported across the media and by everyone, and well-known bookshops were declining in numbers. And, you know, they had to face an online competitor who's, you know, out of control at times, and we had to and various other things, and the arrival of ebooks and everything, and we've come through that period, and now this is the third year of growth. It is small growth. I think, you know, the net growth is tiny, but it's growth, and there aren't actually that many sectors. The other reason it's important, aren't many sectors on the high street of retail that are growing at all. So I think it is a big statement about the way, a few things. One, the way bookshops have figured out, you know, it might be what we're doing, or if you look at a different bookstore, it might be they do something completely different that works for their market. But whatever it is, they've really got a handle on their identity and what it is they need to do to make it work for their community. And so they figured out how to thrive despite all those threats and inequities that exist. And I think that's a really good thing. And I think maybe it's because we've all, books were the first people to face big competition from online. And maybe just we've taken a lot of hard hits, but we've kind of learned our way around it now.
Do you get people who come into the bookshop and sit there and take your advice and then say, thanks, I'm going to go and see what the discount's like online?
You know, the more hands-on you are, the more people enjoy meeting your booksellers. The less that happens. It is always going to happen to a degree, of course. But, you know, I've also had customers where, you know, they've kind of admitted that they might need to do that, you know, and a few years later when they're, like, for example, if they're not a student anymore, they're earning a salary, then they suddenly come back and, you know, or maybe they have kids down the line and then they become your bookshop. I'd still rather they were in my bookshop than anywhere else. Of course, I'd rather they bought the book from me. And of course, it can be galling. But I think the more you engage with people and just chat to people about books, and what we find is people come to us to talk to each of our individual booksellers. They have these little sort of weird cults of personality develop around your booksellers. So, oh, you need a book on, you need a feminist sci-fi novel where you've got to go and see X or Y.
Is there any chance that you're going to do a James Daunt and expand and become a mogul and have lots of shops? Or will you just stay at Mr. B's in Bath?
One of the reasons, you know, it's good that for us that the subscription side of our business has grown is because I don't need to, I can still do that from one basic geographic location. Obviously, I go to and fro to London a bit with the Booksellers Association anyway. I don't know. We never set out to have lots of different physical locations. I'm not saying I never would, but it's never been a plan. Bookshops and, you know, it's a careful economic balancing act. It's fantastic that we're seeing them open up here, there and everywhere now. But each one knows how tough it is to get it up and running. So that's not my top priority.
Well, I can hear voices in the background, and I think that your customers await you, and I'm feeling rather guilty about taking you away
from
them.
I hope they're awaiting me. I hope
we're going to let you go now, but thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And now, after the break, we'll be talking with the novelist Samantha Harvey about her catastrophic lack of sleep. Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. After four finely crafted novels, including The Wilderness, Dear Thief, and 2018's The Western Wind, Samantha Harvey suddenly found herself unable to sleep. Not sleeping badly, or sleeping a bit, but not sleeping at all. Her response is a restless, urgent memoir of the year she spent not sleeping, The Shapeless Unease. When she came to the studio, she began by reading a passage from the book where she offers some clarifications.
When I don't sleep, which is very often, I don't sleep at all. It's not so much that I'm a bad sleeper these days, it's that I'm a non-sleeper. I am a bad sleeper too, but nights of bad sleep are the good nights, because they involve sleep. When I don't sleep, it's not that I feel tired so much as assaulted. In the morning after a night of no sleep, my eyes are sore and tender and can barely open. My joints ache. There's a taste in my mouth which isn't like any other taste, only like a feeling, and that feeling is defeat. My skull aches evenly across its hemisphere. Pain shoots up to some old scars on the crown of my head. I eye the world with suspicion, and everything in it seems to stand back from me with hostility and hatred. There's a force at work that doesn't wish for my well-being. It feels personal. I go up to bed at night. I get beaten up. I come downstairs in the morning. Then I go about the day as if things were normal and I hadn't been beaten up, and everyone else treats me as if I hadn't been beaten up, and that way I survive, but no more than that. When I don't sleep, I spend the night searching the intricacies of my past, trying to find out where I went wrong, trawling through childhood to see if the genesis of the insomnia is there. There's terror when a basic animal need isn't met. At first you fear death, then a worse thing happens. You fear life. You no longer want your life, not on these terms. When I don't sleep, and don't sleep, and don't sleep, I don't want my life. Neither do I have in me the propulsion, courage, know-how, to take it. So I have to endure my life when it's unendurable, and this is an impasse. When I don't sleep, I lie still for several hours with my heart pounding, as if evading some beast. When the adrenaline has built in me, I break, and I get up and hit things, the wall, my head against the wall. I might howl, I might scream. I'll pace, as if trying to stalk down an old, better self that has outrun me.
Thanks very much indeed for that. So I guess I want to start by asking, how did you find yourself with such a lack of sleep?
I still don't really know. I just stopped sleeping quite abruptly a couple of years ago. And
just like that, one night to the next?
And it probably wasn't quite as abrupt as that. When I think back now, it seemed very abrupt. Probably I was having some sort of disturbed sleep for a few weeks before that, but nothing that you would call insomnia. And then I think I had a night of zero sleep, and I didn't know that that was even possible until then. And it was as if once my brain and body learned that that was a thing that you could do, it knew no bounds.
Just when it did it.
Decided that that's what it would do.
Did you find yourself looking for reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think this book is largely that. It's a search for reasons or clues or something that would enable me to uncover this thing in myself.
That was the only thing you could write, the only thing you could think about almost.
Yeah, I was obsessed by it, completely obsessed by it.
So what were the reasons you hit upon?
Oh, life is enigmatic and strange, and humans are complex. There are certainly triggers. I know that there were things going on at the time I got insomnia. And I had been feeling, for probably a year or two before that, more anxious than usual. And not just in a sort of vaguely worrying about things, but in a more sort of pathological way, just anxious about things that I had no need to be anxious about, but I found myself getting locked into this quite fretful state of mind. So I'm sure the way was paved for it. It didn't come from nowhere, but it certainly felt like it came from nowhere.
Why not write another novel, as your unnamed friend suggests?
Well, I couldn't. Nothing came to me.
Just couldn't. Impossible.
It was impossible, yeah. I didn't have an idea for a start, and I can't really blame that on having insomnia. But I didn't have the bandwidth for it while I was in the depths of insomnia. I didn't have the capacity for that, the sort of architecture of a novel, you know, the planning, the scheming, the thinking of character arcs, that kind of thing.
The difficult business of imagining stuff.
Exactly, of yeah, that huge effort of invention, which I always find hard anyway. That's, for me, the hardest part of writing a novel. I started writing because it's the thing I know how to do best, I suppose. It's the place I always go to in myself when I need to be grounded and I need some solace and some structure. So I just started writing without any plan.
Mm. Do you write about Brexit, about changes in your own body, and also you write about the death of a cousin as well as maybe another thing that might have triggered it, which is strange or maybe perfectly natural because death and sleep seem so intimately connected.
Yeah, they are. I mean, there are so many parallels. Obviously, when you go to sleep, it is a kind of mini death because you are unconscious for that time. You're not aware of the world or of yourself except through dreams. And I think there is that fear, you know, of going to sleep, and while you're asleep, you're powerless. You don't have any agency. So I think there are parallels between the two. And then it's very well documented that bereavement causes sleeplessness. I mean, my cousin's death really affected me, and we weren't that close. You know, I had known him quite well as a child, but I think it was more that his death sort of opened the door to a whole lot of possible loss. I thought, well, if one of my own contemporaries can die, and somebody I, you know, ran around the garden with when I was a child, then what keeps me safe? What keeps anyone else around me safe? And it was just that a very anxious frame of mind that I was in that started to extrapolate in all sorts of catastrophic ways. And I think it was, you know, it's a kind of midlifey thing as well, where you start to look at what's ahead of you, and some of it doesn't look that promising.
I guess I'm wondering about the difference between this piece of writing and your other work as well, because I mean there are moments in The Shapeless Unease when your own experience, that what your own pain, seems to come through almost raw, this kind of wound almost gaping on the page. Was this directness a kind of release, or was it something that you had to work for because the form demanded it?
I mean, there was just so little design in this book. I wrote whatever came out when I sat down to write, and I had no idea what that would be. And it wrote itself very easily. I mean, I sort of sometimes say that I wrote this book by accident, or I wrote it without quite noticing, because whereas with writing a novel, it's very premeditated. You can't write a novel without noticing, unless you're Stephen King, apparently, and wrote it when drunk. But I certainly can't write a novel without noticing I'm doing it. But this, I think, because when you're very sleep deprived, you're in a state that is really raw and really edgy and has this kind of very unpleasant electric energy to it. And it's very open. Everything is kind of available in you in a very uneasy way. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing kind of expansive about that. It's just really raw, and in a funny way, it's quite conducive to creativity. And because you can't hold anything back, your filters are gone. So that's where I wrote this book from, and I had no sense that it would become a book, and certainly not a published one. And I do have reservations about that even now, as someone who's only ever written fiction, and even then fiction that's very unautobiographical.
It's, I mean, your fiction is an extremely careful mechanism that gets from this point to that point, as you say, according to a plan. This is almost the opposite of that. It's a kind of shapelessness which reflects the shapelessness of your mental state.
Absolutely. And then again, you know, I think all the things that this book is obsessed by and preoccupied by are the same things that my novels are obsessed by and the same things that I keep turning over and over all the way through my writing life, you know, faith and questions of what, of why we're here, of who we are, of selfhood. The book is so much about the question of whether we can know ourselves, whether we even have a self to know as such, whether there's anything there to find. And in the case of The Shapeless Unease, this desperate need to find something, because it might be the answer, or it might unlock something of the enigma of why I wasn't sleeping. So in a way, I don't think there's anything new in this book that I haven't already looked at in my novels. It's just that I've turned the lens on myself and it's much more direct.
And as I say, much more raw. I mean, do you think that that's a tone that you now will be able to use in the rest of your writing? Something you can access elsewhere?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, there's something very uncurated about this book. And the effortlessness of writing it is something I would really like to be able to to emulate in other books. Something about the openness of sitting down for this and writing for the sake of writing, writing out of the need to write and for no other reason, just because you need to do it, not because it pays your mortgage or your publisher is waiting for it or because you've got an idea of a character in mind, but because you need to do it and your day can't go ahead without you doing it. That sort of really urgent kind of disposition that I was in when I wrote this book, I definitely would like to be able to emulate that more. And there's always been some of that in my writing, but never as direct as this one. And, you know, one really substantially great thing that has come out of having insomnia for me is this book and the way it's restored my faith in writing and my own need to write. You know, never mind whether the world needs me to write, but my own need to write.
Even if it's slightly disconcerting to see the results.
Yeah.
You couldn't quite leave fiction entirely behind, though, could you? What's your story about a man who loses his wedding ring while robbing a cash machine? What's that doing in the middle of a memoir about insomnia?
Yeah, it's a good question. What is it doing there? I mean, because I didn't really ever think this would be published, I never worried about the sort of coherence of its form.
That's but just what you needed to write that day.
Yeah, so there's a section in this book that's about language and recursion and so on. And in that, I was writing about this tribe of people in the Brazilian Amazon and their language for some reason, because it was one of those things that I was fleetingly obsessed by while I was sleep deprived. And I gave an example sentence just out of thin air as a recursive sentence, and that sentence was about a man who robs a cash machine and loses his wedding ring and blah, blah, blah. And then probably a couple of weeks later, I thought, again, in that weird, obsessive state of mind that sleep deprivation puts you in, I thought, I must write that story.
This is the next morning after some awful night.
Yes, yeah. With, you know, often with no sleep at all. I thought, I've got to write that story. I've got to find out about that man.
I mean, you say that you're writing about recursion sort of as if it was just one of those things that you were sort of thinking about. But isn't recursion in some sense the seat of consciousness? That our ability to reflect on ourselves is what it means to feel something in some sense. And so therefore, isn't it kind of the problem or the opposite to sleep?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, because I start that section, what prompted that section on recursion in the book is a memory of my mum singing The Windmills of Your Mind when she was doing the housework. And I had this very vivid memory of that, and it was a sort of I just remembered the sound of her singing and then associated that with me sort of just playing away at something while she was doing that. And that song is something I have grown up with, and that it's always felt, it's always, I mean, it's such a vivid song anyway, but it's always felt like it's expressed something about what it is to be conscious, that, that funny drain of circling thoughts that sort of go round and round and never get anywhere. And
the tunnel that's leading to a tunnel of its own.
Exactly. And that's the human mind, it seems to me. And it, that is the mind that you experience very vividly at 3 a.m. You know, there's, as you say, the opposite of sleep. It's not just that you're awake, it's that you're awake with your mind, which won't stop. And in fact, the more tired you get, the less it will stop. It just gets more and more insistent and nagging and often meaningless.
You describe a moment in the pub shortly before you began having trouble with sleep, when you had a powerful sensation that everything around you might not be real, a worry you describe as anxiety's jackpot. But was your philosophical training no help in countering this sense of metaphysical vertigo?
Yeah, it's no help at all. because, you know, the sort of first year philosophy undergrad thing of what if I'm a brain in a vat?
And when you're a standard problem, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. And when you're 18, you think, oh, what if I'm a brain in a vat? And then when you're 44, you think, oh, what if I'm a brain in a vat? And suddenly it becomes a real problem. Well, it does if you're me anyway.
Yeah, and you weren't convinced by any of the kind of standard answers.
Because, you know, what could a standard answer be? You know, the whole conundrum of it is, if you really are a brain in a vat and you've been programmed to believe in your own objective reality, of course you're going to believe in your own objective reality. So you can never know if you are or not. And for a while, that really troubled me. I think it still does trouble me if I think about it.
Yeah, you're not convinced by Occam's razor, you know. Why invent a whole kind of thing about that if it's much more straightforward to imagine that actually reality exists?
But reality isn't straightforward, is it? I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah, but your vat has to sit in some reality, so you've got two of them. Oh, no! Isn't that worse?
Okay.
It's not doing it for you.
I'll see. I'll go away and think about it tonight.
And maybe just philosophy, maybe rationality is just not enough to deal with this kind of existential terror.
Yeah, I think it's not, because it's not, philosophy is, and logic is rational, and fear is not rational, and that's its whole, that's how it gets its existence, you know, it gets into the gaps between rationality and its, you know, it starts to eclipse reason, and I think that's where it takes hold.
What about the consolations of God?
Well, I have a section in the book about a conversation with a Christian friend of mine who's deeply thoughtful, intelligent, sort of wonderful thinker, and really rigorous in her thinking. But she also has Christianity, and I just have always envied it so much, her capacity to believe. And it's not that her belief is flawless. And unerring. She doubts all the time, and I think that's a healthy part of belief, but still she has this belief in God. And I thought, you know, at this point when I was having a conversation with her, I was very sleep deprived, and I began to think in my own slightly mad way that if only I could believe in God, then I would start sleeping. Maybe that was the thing that I was lacking, you know. But I've never had the capacity to. I've always wanted to.
The more I look at religion and science, you say, the less difference I see between them. I mean, there are obviously many scientific results. We can't go out and test them all for ourselves, but many scientific results we have to take on trust. But isn't there a very big difference between the kind of belief we have in science and the kind of belief we have in God?
Yes, there's a huge difference. But when I think about reason as the sort of vehicle for science, and it's always reason versus faith, you know, that is brought up. we arrive at our scientific knowledge through reason, and we arrive at our religious knowledge through faith. I look at reason and I begin to think, well, reason is a capacity of the human mind. It's the only thing we have. And it's sort of a platitude to say that if we use reason, we will arrive at things that seem rational to us. Of course.
That's the point.
That's the point of reason. But how are we to know that reason is anything worth having? You know, it just allows us to arrive at a set of things that we call rational and that we therefore decide, because we've reasoned them, must be worth knowing. But it's more that I'm questioning reason as the sort of the golden ticket.
I guess the obvious response to that is that there are plenty of scientists who cast doubt on whether you can believe in faith for results about the earth or history or morality or whatever. But there are very few men of God of whatever sort who get worried about getting on a jet plane or using a smartphone. Science kind of works at some level.
Although there are plenty of scientists who have a religious belief, and certainly more so in the past, maybe less so now, but still, I think when physics gets very theoretical, it becomes quite faith-based.
There are many people who think string theory is just a pile of imagination.
Exactly, and we've arrived at so much of our scientific knowledge through leaps of faith. So actually, I don't think there's that much difference. I completely accept the difference between faith and reason, and how one looks much more sturdy than the other. Reason looks much more sturdy than faith. But I just question whether it really is.
Another thread that runs through the book is the way you talk about the doctors who you went to ask for help, who sit there stony or sphinx-like or even combative. Mm. Do medical professionals, scientists of a sort, do these medical professionals have a trouble with sleeplessness?
Well, my doctors did. Actually, I did find a very sympathetic doctor in the end. But even she was stumped by it. You know, she didn't have any answers. So fair enough. I don't really expect doctors to have answers to something as mysterious as sleep. We don't understand sleep. That's the bottom line. Nobody understands why we do it or how we do it. But I think as a sort of a separate issue that the NHS is woefully ill-equipped to deal with insomnia. And I think it's because it falls somewhere between mental and physical, and it's very difficult to sort of tease the two out, so nobody really knows where to begin with it. So they don't.
As well as the kind of well-documented troubles that the NHS has dealing with mental health problems at all.
It's
kind of a perfect sweet spot for getting ignored, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah.
Almost 250,000 people read an extract from The Shapeless Unease on the Guardian website, with an avalanche of comments on social media from readers who recognise themselves in your pain.
Mm.
Do you think that's a sign that sleeplessness is a modern epidemic, or do you think we're just able to talk about something that we were never able to discuss before?
It's a really good question. I just don't know the answer to it. I guess some people have always slept badly, and sleep problems have been around since the dawn of time, and I don't think we can blame everything on the modern world.
On the smartphone.
Yeah, or Brexit. But there is something about the world we live in now that has a kind of nervous energy to it, in the way that we're drip-fed information, a lot of it news, which is often fearful. And it's coming at us in sort of not, you don't sit down and watch the news anymore, you just get sort of fed it through the day, one headline at a time. And the headlines have to become more and more kind of shouty to grab your attention in this huge sea of noise. And it just feels like there's a kind of whir of energy and tension around that we are all immersed in. I mean, I don't even have a phone. You know, I still somehow through osmosis get that drip feed of opinion that's quickly followed by reaction, that's quickly followed by another reaction, and then someone being taken down or shamed in some way. And we live in such a reactive world and not a very kind of wisely responsive world. And I think that must in some way contribute towards it.
If writing is dreaming, as you suggest, then can writing help the insomniac?
It helped me hugely. I think it didn't help in the sense that I finished what I was writing and lo, I was cured, if only. But the act of writing was a huge solace and very grounding. And I think there's something about writing that kind of is a form of alchemy for me, where you can take the raw material of yourself that's sort of, you know, even when you're going through something that's very rough and very dark, you can take that and you can make it into a sentence, and you can make it into a beautiful sentence, and somehow in doing that you've alchemized it, and then you stack all those sentences up and you've created something that is bigger than yourself and that is wiser than yourself.
The cure for insomnia, you suggest, is perhaps wild swimming, or maybe it's the realization that no things are fixed, everything passes. This too, is that the secret?
Well, it's not the secret. And it's a very tongue-in-cheek cure. But when I get into cold water, into a lake or a river, and I put my head under the water, in that moment I'm cured of insomnia.
For that moment.
For that moment, yeah. It's the antithesis of sleeplessness, just getting your head into cold water and feeling the sort of release of pressure and being utterly invigorated by that, and it being all enveloping, so you can't think about anything else, just this water that's around you. And that has been very sustaining for me. It's not a cure.
How are you sleeping now?
Better. Not well, but better. Thank you.
Samantha Harvey speaking to Richard Lee. The Shapeless Unease is published by Jonathan Cape in the UK and Grove Press in the US. And that's all for this week. Next week's episode will be out on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, and we will be speaking to the best-selling author Janine Cummings in a very raw and emotional interview. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, get in touch on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And remember, you can subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
Me, Richard Lee.
Me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.